This is a recording of Larry S. from Visalia, California, taped at the monthly Delta Intergroup speaker meeting in Stockton, California, on Saturday, January 9, 1993, in observance of the 11th tradition stating anonymity at the public level. Please keep this tape within the fellowship and observe the anonymity of all AA speakers.
Speaker of the night, and this is Larry from Visalia, and I don't know much about him, but I sure like to speak his tapes. I listen to his tapes, and he's a lot of fun. So I want you to welcome Larry from Visalia.
My name's Larry, and I'm an alcoholic. I don't just love it when somebody brings a big book. I used to like to go to meetings. When the guy brought the big book, I knew we were in trouble. I'm glad to be here, glad to be sober. There's something that happened to me real great today. We went team roping, but that wasn't it. And I got to spend a lot of time with my friend, and that wasn't it. And my family is out in the motorhome, and that's that. I like that part of it, but that wasn't it. What was it is I didn't want to take a drink today. That's what was great. Never thought about it. And Jimmy, I want to ask Jimmy how he's doing.
Great!
That's kind of Jimmy and I's own personal story. We were trying to figure out what we were going to do to make this a fun meeting. We do have a horse, and he is not in the motorhome. He is with us. We went to team roping today in series, and we left him there. We're going back after him, I hope. It's a privilege to be part of Alcoholics Anonymous. I usually say that. And the way I want to start my pitch and the way I want to start talking about what I'm going to talk about is tell you exactly how I feel and what's going on with me right now, so you know what kind of person I am and what I'm thinking about and what happens to me when I get up here. I'm one of them alcoholics that when I was going to high school and grade school, if I ever had to stand up in front of a group, I ditched school. If I ever had to do an oral report, I never showed up. Because I don't know about you, but whenever I got to get up here, it's a real test of going to any length. Right now, my knees are kind of knocking together, and all of a sudden, my lips get dry, and my tongue gets kind of thick. You know, and then my brain just kind of starts thinking, what the hell am I going to talk about, you know? And I'm one of them alcoholics that sometimes I have to rely on it. And if you've done to your brain what I've done to mine, sometimes that's a real chore. So I never know if it's going to work itself out or not, see? But they told me when I first got here that I'd be willing to get up here, and so here I am. And I'm willing to do that. Jimmy and I, we were going to bring my horse, and we were going to, because we like to do things a little bit different. We like to have a lot of fun, and we were kind of joking about what we were going to do, and he thought about putting me in Christmas lights, being how Christmas just is just over with, and putting my horse with Christmas lights on him. If you've ever seen The Electric Horseman, that movie with Robert Redford, he was going to have me ride in this side door with them Christmas lights, and then I was going to introduce my horse as Blackout. I thought that was kind of a good idea. You notice I'm out. I got three drinks up here, so I can make a decision on which one I want to use. I got a little Coke diet. I've been sober. I got kind of, must feel a little bit like a wimp, you know. I didn't cowboy up and make it all the way through New Year's. My sobriety date, 1975, December the 26th. And if I'd have continued to drink, I'd have been dead. I never got to be here. I'm one of them alcoholics who drank for a period of about 13 years. And my drinking was the first few times I drank. I like what it done to me. And I continued to drink until, never tried to stop. I continued to drink until I was either going to die or get sober, and I wasn't 30 years old yet. And so my drinking career wasn't real long compared to some, you know, but it was long enough for me. There's something that I want to talk about, and then I'm going to tell a couple of funny stories, and then I'm going to tell you about my pitch, but there's something that's bothering me, and I don't want to put a down. My wife's outside. She said, now don't put a down thing on the meeting, and she told me the last time I spoke, said, don't try to be funny, they'll all get up and leave. And then the last bit, she was sitting in the front row, and I'm up here, you know, and I get this big book out, and I start talking like I know something, see, and she starts laughing. I'm trying to concentrate and be real serious up here and tell you people about how Alcoholics Anonymous works, and she's sitting in the front row laughing. She's been in Al-Anon ever since I got sober, so you can imagine what I have to go through. Jimmy and I got her a while ago when the people started coming in. Jimmy and I, we were just sitting there, you know, kind of taking it easy. And my wife, Irene, she was popping the curtain. And Jimmy said something about, you know, the old days when you used to look for that drug to come home. See? Still got some of that stuff. Popping that curtain to see if anybody's coming. Betty Parker, homemaker, Exeter. Betty Mae Parker, 51 years old, died of heart failure Thursday night at the Visalia Hospital. Betty, I want to talk about her because she's gone, and she died. And it's kind of a bittersweet thing because Betty was a real nice lady. And she started out in life with a good attitude, and things worked real good for her. She got married to a guy named Fred, and she had a couple of nice kids, and they got a good job, and got the house, and no real bad problems, you know, everything's working real good. And Betty was real instrumental in saving her sister's life. I've been sober for a while, and they called me one night and said, we got to do something about Mary, so we need to do a little intervention. So I went over, and I told them what we could do, and give them some information, and got the family all together. And every time Mary got drunk, well, Betty would take her to detox. She quit enabling her and covering up for her, you know, and doing the things and saying the things that got her out of trouble. She'd haul her butt to detox. And when Mary would wake up, she was in detox, out of a blackout, see? And then she'd get drunk, and then she'd show up at Betty's, and she'd haul her to detox. Well, see, Mary got tired of waking up in detox, and so we kept her there long enough until she got sober, and then she got 10 years of sobriety. And Betty was doing just fine. And then Betty, the lady that I'm reading about in here, her husband died. He lost his job, and he went up to up in this area. And he got up here, and he died. And just before he lost his job, right after he lost his job, they had to cancel all of their, he had a real nice job and had to cancel all of their health insurance. And they canceled some other things, like things that are real important. And he died and left Betty with no life insurance and no health insurance. And so she got kind of lost. And then Betty got into a little bit of our disease after her husband died, and she lost everything because she had to figure out how to cope. How to deal, you know, and this disease started telling her this is a way to do it. And I shared my birthday. I'll get through this without crying. I shared my birthday Thursday night, and there happened to be a guy come into the meeting, and he was upset. And he was talking about a gal who had almost had 90 days sober, and she'd had a heart attack and died. And he didn't mention her name. And he's sitting in my birthday meeting, and I'm celebrating 17 years. And when I got home, there was a message on my notepad that Irene, my wife, wrote down that Betty Parker had died. And the family called me and wanted me to get her 90-day chip. I got her 90-day chip with me tonight. We're going to put it on her casket Tuesday. She didn't quite make 90 days, but she died sober. She hadn't had anything to drink. She hadn't had any pills. Her mind was clear. Her boy had called me and told me how great it was to get to know his mom again because the 90 days they had sober was great. Almost 90 days. Well, she's going to have more 90 days now, see? because God called her home, and I'm going to go by Tuesday. I'm going to go by the boy's house tomorrow and give him the chip, and they're going to put it in her casket. And Betty's going to be okay, see? Because the God, as I understand him, called her home, and she had a lot of physical problems, and she didn't need to be here anymore. And now she's at peace. And so it's a kind of a bittersweet thing, you know, because I understand that when we do get called home, that that's a special thing, too. And Betty has, she's going to a big meeting someplace tonight. And I feel like she's here with us, and that's the reason I want to talk about her, because she's special. Her name's Betty Parker. She's one of us, and she's doing okay. Okay. I'll tell you a little bit about my drinking, and then I'm going to talk about recovery. That's what it's about for me, staying sober. I've been here 17 years, and I'm just getting started. I'm just now figuring out there's a lot of stuff in this big book that I don't know. There's a lot of things in here that I continue to read. I learned some new words about thorough, you know, and about improve and continue that are in these steps. And I just found out that you got to use God every time you take a step. I didn't know that when I did it. Even though I went through the process and followed directions and did it, I didn't know that every time I went through a step, I did pray. And just lately, I found out that every step in this book, three on, you say a little prayer before you do that step. I like that. I'm going to talk about him tonight, see, because he's special in my life. A little bit about my drinking so that you know I'm a drunk. Because I know you can't tell by looking at me. Look like a cowboy, huh? Got a belt buckle and black hat. Jimmy and I, we come down by Mooney Boulevard. We didn't get to go down Mooney Boulevard, but we come by Mooney Boulevard. Mooney Boulevard is the main drag in our little town where everybody goes, you know, and they used to drag it, the teenagers drag it, and all the stores. In 1972, I had a blue car and a brand new horse trailer and a big old red horse and a big black hat and a half pint of VO. And I was going to go team roping. Team roping is that way. Mooney Boulevard is that way. So the only way I can get to team roping is go down Mooney Boulevard first. Because I got this nice rig and this black hat and this half pint. And I don't know about your drinking, but my drinking made me feel good. And when I'd go down Mooney Boulevard with this black hat, looking in that mirror, and that song's on that tape player, you know, Merle Haggard, turned 21 in prison, doing life without parole, I knew that people on Moody Boulevard knew who I was. I'm Larry Sloan. I'm a team roper. Well, today, we went by Moody Boulevard. Then I was driving a 72 Ford with that brand new horse trailer and that big red horse. When we went by Mooney Boulevard today, I was in a $50,000 motorhome. Nice big red horse. Had my chauffeur, Jimmy. AA's great, ain't it? And we didn't have to drive down Mooney Boulevard, and I didn't have to wave, and we went team roping. We drove right straight to where we were going to rope at. And we unloaded our horse, and I wasn't thinking about everybody looking at us in that $50,000 motorhome and my chauffeur Jimmy. And you seeing me and thinking how great I am. I was thinking about my team roping and speaking tonight and Betty Parker. I was thinking about being here and asking my God, as I understand him, to help me do a good job. See, because I don't know about you, but I'm not capable of doing a good job up here. The Larry Sloan that I am, and the knowledge and the ability that I have, and the education, and the brain cells that I got, is not capable of doing a good job up here. see? But Alcoholics Anonymous. And this thing that Betty Parker has got to know real good today, called God, is going to do things for me tonight that I can't do for myself. He's going to give me the words to say. He's going to give me the thoughts. He's going to give me the things that are important. He's going to keep me on track. He's going to see that a cowboy up and do it right no matter what I want to do wrong. And that's the way my higher power works for me. I've learned in this fellowship that every meeting we have, the co-founder is there. See? And so when I get up here and I stumble, I don't have to worry because the co-founder is here. The two co-founders are here. The main co-founder is God, as I understand him, is here, and he's going to help me do this. The other two co-founders, in every meeting we go to, they're with us. That's Bill and Bob. They're with us in every meeting. And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is about for me. Stay with this white drink. It looks pretty good. My drinking was kind of that way with that attitude from the first time I drank. I don't know about you, but the first time I drank was at a high school, and I was one of them funny looking little kid with pimples on their face and kind of skinny and never did speak up in class too much, you know, and the girls never did look at me. And one day I got, my family was a real good family. My dad worked hard, you know, and he ended up buying me a brand new white 61 Chevrolet Impala. And I drove that car to school one day, and all of a sudden, things happened. It had pipes on it coming out the bottom. It had them wheels that you could see turning as you drove down the road. And the front end was down like this. You couldn't stick a cigarette pack under the front of it. And the girl said after class that Larry's cute. So you can see from 1961, when they said he was cute, you can see what happened to me. The way I turned out the way I did in 1972 on Money Boulevard. I still thought the girls were saying he's cute. There's something that separates me from other people who can drink, and my wife is one of them, but I got a wife who sees the damage that this damn disease does, and she chooses not to, and isn't that great? She just says, no, I don't want to drink. And she doesn't have to worry about it. I don't even think about it. It never enters her mind. I don't want to drink. I see what alcohol does to people, and, you know, the disease of alcoholism, I hate it, and don't want to drink. I walked into a school dance after I had a little bit to drink, and I can remember like it was yesterday with this old skinny look I had and these pimples on my face, you know, and before I went in, I had a few drinks and looked in that rearview mirror again, and them pimples was gone. And this hair that I still got, thank God, was combed just right. And alcohol done something for me that does that it doesn't do for anybody else that's not an alcoholic. It gave me power. It gave me the feeling that everything's going to be all right. And I walked into that dance and I had rhythm. And I got on the dance floor and I had rhythm. All my feet went the right way at the right time. I didn't have any butterflies. I walked over to a pretty girl and I asked her to dance. And she said yes. And there's something that separates me from other people who can drink. As soon as them feet got a little bit where they wasn't working just right, this little thing off here called alcoholism, this mental disease I got, said there's some more booze in the car. Back out to the car. Drank a little more. Back in. Back out to the car. The first night I drank, I had a little blackout. I don't remember how I got home. And I kind of like that name, Blackout. I think I'll change that. That hurts his name. And then the weekends just, you know how it is if you're an alcoholic, and I continue to drink, and I continue to drink on weekends, and I didn't get interested in school sports, and I played football, and I got interested in going to football and setting up in stands and getting drunk. Except I never wanted to get drunk. I wanted my alcohol to actually look good. I always wanted to drink just enough to where you get down here, and then it happens. And then this happens. And then you want a little more, and then the hat's just right. And you walk into the dance floor. I wanted to feel good. never wanted to get sloppy ass drunk. I didn't want to ruin the party. I wanted to feel good. But that wasn't what happened. I continued to drink because I went through my process of my drinking for 13 years until I ended up in a little room with no wife, no kids, no scholarship at a school that the coach was talking about, and no family that wanted me around, and I ended up going to die. I was having little strokes in my face, and I was going to die. I was going to die, and it was a few days before New Year's, and I was going to die. I didn't have any other drunks left. And when I think about nobody wanting me, that reminds me of what Jimmy and I had done yesterday. You know, when you study this big book, and you listen to these things, and you talk about helping drunks, and helping alcoholics, you know, the big book talks a little bit about bringing them home. You know, now Jimmy and I, we spent all day yesterday trying to get out of bringing somebody home with us. We worked hard at it. We done a 12-step call that took us almost 10 hours. Try to find him a place to go so we didn't have to bring him home. Jimmy looked at me. I'm not taking him home. And Jimmy lives by himself. Well, I'm not taking him home. I got a wife and kids. So we hauled his ass all the way to Porterville to try to get him in a recovery home. And they tell us, okay, yeah, but... They look at him, you know, and he's 43 years old. His name's Billy Underwood, and he's a nice guy. Nobody wants him. He spent his Social Security money in 4 days, $600. He don't get paid again till the 1st, and he can't keep his teeth in because he don't have any of that, polygrip. So they don't want him in Porterville. So we haul him back to Visalia, and we're going to put him in Pine. And that's another recovery home, you know. And Jimmy and I are looking at each other. We don't want to take him home. And Pine don't want him. So we call Hanford, another little town. They don't want him. We say, you got any family? Billy's teeth drops down, you know. They won't stay in his mouth. No. What about your wife? You got, no, hell, you take me over there. Hell, she'll throw me out. And then what was funny, he don't know nothing about music right now, but he said something that's a hit song. You know, he said, where am I going to go when I get home? What am I going to do when I get home? Where he was staying at, they throwed all his clothes out in the front yard, see? Where am I going to live when I get home? So me and Jimmy got tickled at that. And they didn't know what to do with him. And Hanford didn't want him. Hell, they didn't want nothing to do with him. So we went to another place, and they didn't want him. And so by this time, it's cost me $11 messing with him. So they had to buy him polygrip. I don't have false teeth yet, but polygrip, what, $6-$8, wasn't it? Pack of cigarettes, so this, a carton of cigarettes. So I don't know how much Jimmy got into him for, but he's already conning me. I'll tell you what we've done. Jimmy's got a deal in his pocket right now. Now, I must have been really weak. I don't know what happened, but Jimmy's got a deal in his pocket. Billy has clothes in Bakersfield, and the rent on where he's got them stored is up tomorrow, $21. Billy talked me in to sending them a check to pay for that bill. See, the alkies get smarter. And then I'm sitting there, you know, feeling, because I'm grateful, see? I'm grateful. I got this gratitude. I just had my sobriety birthday, you know, and I'm going roping, and I'm going up here and speak, and my wife's happy, and everything's going great for me, and I'm grateful. Billy says, you think you can buy me cigarettes for a month? Because I don't get my check till the 1st. Yeah, sure, Billy. I forgot what 3 packs of cigarettes a day cost for 30 days. I don't smoke. When I'm smoking, it's 40 cents a pack. Nobody wants Billy. Nobody wants him. So Jimmy and I, we're getting real hot now, see, and so we contact mental health. Because one recovery home turned us down, and you can't turn us down if you're federally funded. You can't kick this guy out if you got a spot for him. So we go to mental health, and we raise hell with the head people. Jimmy was in there, and by the time I got there, Jimmy had already got straightened out. But we were going to raise hell with these number one people that's supposed to help us people, see? Because us alcoholics don't want to take you home. I should let Jimmy tell the rest of the story. We found Billy a place to stay. And Jimmy and I are not going to desert him. See, we found him a place where we can put him up for a couple of days. And Monday morning, we're going and I'm going to take him his damn cigarettes. And we're going to haul his ass to meetings. And we're going to take care of him. But that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is all about. I kind of like recovery homes because, you know, used to, they're the sane asylums, what they used to call them. Recovery homes because you can take somebody, you don't have to take them home. I kind of like that deal. My wife gets upset because I have brought some home. I'm grateful I'm here. I'm grateful I'm here and part of this fellowship. I'm grateful that I'm an alcoholic. That may seem strange, but if I wasn't an alcoholic, I wouldn't feel the way that I do today. I mean, it seems kind of strange to say that, even for me, when I say it. But I mean that. I mean that. I got some funny stuff, but also I got to get into my recovery process here. I'm going to cover a little bit on this, but this is important for me. I don't know about you, but it's important for me. I don't know about you when you started looking up how it works, but they got a word that starts out in this book and it says thoroughly. Thoroughly followed our path. And I don't know how smart you are, you know, but I don't have a college education, but my old stupid brain said, let's look that word up in the dictionary. Thoroughly. Thoroughly. From beginning to end. Hey, if I start this program, I'm going to stay with it. That's what thoroughly means. It says how it works thoroughly. Beginning to end. Going from one point of origin to destination without change. Webster's Dictionary. Without change. And what that means for an old drunk like me is I follow this big book without change. As I go through these steps, I don't change them. I go from point one to step one, how it works thoroughly, just like it tells me to do it in this big book. I didn't know that when I got here. I'd read that, yeah, well, thoroughly, I know what that means, see, but I took the time. They told me that you take the time, easy does it. Start learning what words mean, stupid, and you can figure out this thing. And I got me a dictionary, and I started looking that up. Then I got real smart, see, I got through all these steps, and I was doing real good, and I done it like they told me to do, you know, and then I got some benefits in step nine. If you do all these steps, you cannot do these steps and drink. It's impossible to do these steps like the big book tells you and drink. I cannot drink today. I've done these steps and I continue to do them. See, continue. All of a sudden, I got a lot of benefits from step nine. I got a lot of promises out of the book. And then I look at step ten, continue. Continue to take personal inventory. So I got the dictionary out. Continue means you endure and you last. You hang, you cowboy up and you stay. You keep going, you keep going. No matter what happens, you stay. Okay? Then it said improve. You know, they got to talking about thought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact. Well, improve is not maintenance. I don't know if you've been in this AA meeting and say the three maintenance steps. 10, 11, and 12, got to keep maintenance. Well, if any of you's got a car, you know what maintenance is. You go out there and you wash it and you keep it clean. That's maintenance. Improving means you change stuff on it. You make it better. You improve. So I got the dictionary out. Improve, to enhance or increase value of quality. Continue, see? Improve. Continue. Improve. Thoroughly. Three little words that make a lot of difference in my sobriety. See, I'm one of them drunks who got around here and I got a lot of benefits and then I kind of wanted to be a victim of my own success. I got the wife and the car, the job. The privileges that Alcoholics Anonymous have got to offer, the feelings, see? But I got to continue. If you want to have the real grace and the real happiness that Alcoholics Anonymous has got to offer, then you do step 12. And that's what Jimmy and I spent all day yesterday doing. We changed our plans for another alcoholic, not because of him. I had to take my horse to the vet yesterday at 2:30. Well, we hadn't done anything with Billy yet. So I called the vet, said it won't be there. Not because of Billy, because of me. See, I'm doing this step 12. I'm changing my plans, not because of Billy, because I know that Billy has no place to go. Nobody wanted Billy. And that's where I've been. I understand where Billy's at. When he looked in my eyes, you know, and he says, can you get me a pack of cigarettes? What about taking you to your wife? I can't go there. You got anybody that cares about you? No. Take you to a recovery home where they're supposed to help you. They don't want you. Jimmy and I said, we'll take you. Alcoholics Anonymous will take you. And that's what it's about for me. That's a little bit on recovery, you know. I'm not gifted with the words, and this book is something that you got to continue to do, and that's what works for me. I can go to a lot of meetings, I can listen to a lot of people, and I can get a lot of opinions and a lot of information, and a little thing that I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous is what works, because I check it out in the book. The book. That's where co-founders are at. They're in this book. God, as I understand Him, our main co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, our main founder is in this book. He gives us these words. I'm waiting on my co-founder to help me right now. I'm just kidding. I know right where I'm at. Okay. I'll tell the stupid horse story. I tell it once a year. The only reason my friends come up here so they can hear me make an ass out of myself. Me being a cowboy, you know, I had a friend of mine, he's not sober yet, and I've been trying to help him stay sober, you know, and I know I don't have the ability, but I try like hell, and I've hauled him to meetings, I've done everything, to detox, and we hauled him to detox one time at Hanford, you know, and he's been drunk for 6 months, and Woody was driving, and he had an old pickup, you know, and we were driving like hell, and Ed's been drunk for 6 months, and he just been trying to kill himself, you know, and he just drunk, he's sitting there in the seat about half passed out, and he looked over at Woody and said, why don't you slow down? You're going to kill us. Ed, you've been trying to kill yourself now for 6 months. You've been drunk and you're worried about my damn driving. That was Ed. Ed was a guy who knew I knew a lot about horses, and so he called me and said, Larry, I've got a horse over by two, Larry, and I want you to go help me get it. I said, okay. So first we had to get drunk before we decided to go do that. And Ed's pickup broke down, so we went by a car lot, and he knew the guy who owned the car lot real good, and he gave us a brand new Chevy pickup. So Ed got in, you know, and we decided to go, and I'm driving, and we have no horse trailer. And Ed's worried about that, you know, and I said, that's no problem, Ed, I'm a cowboy. So we go to Tulare, and we have no sideboards on this pickup truck. And we get over there, you know, and I'm talking to Ed and telling him all this stuff, and Ed's looking at me, and, you know, and we pull up there, and this little old horse, he's in the dairy, and he just got, you know, horse crap all over him and cow crap all over him. And Ed looks at me, and he said, well, what are we going to do, Larry? And I said, well, we're going to put him in the truck. Ed said, we're going to put him in the truck. And I said, yeah, Ed, we're going to put him in the front seat. So me being the smart one of the two, Ed looked at me and he said, Larry, that's a good idea. Now, me being a real smart one of the two, I put the horse's ass over by Ed. Now, we crammed this little horse in the front seat of a pickup. And when you get worried if I'm telling the truth or not, I do have documented proof. Well, we get him in there and he kicks the back window out of the pickup truck. And this dairy man, he's just laughing like hell, you know. He's got shit all over him. And if you don't know where we live, Two Larry is on the left side of where we live. Ed, where I live, and Visalia and Mooney Boulevard. Ed lives on this side of Visalia and Mooney Boulevard. So what we decided to do, me being high intelligence, we decided to take that horse to Ed's house. But I decided to go down Mooney Boulevard. So we're going down Mooney Boulevard, you know, and hell, I'm in a hurry because that horse is stinking. It's a summer night and it's hot and there's bugs all over the front windshield of that pickup truck. And this stupid ass in front of me is driving real slow on Mooney Boulevard, just the other side of Mooney's Grove. And I blink my lights and, you know, get the hell out of the way. He moves over and I go on by. He comes back in, turns the red lights on. So I'm looking in the rearview mirror, you know, and I look at Ed and look at that stupid-ass horse. That cop, he's walking up real slow, you know, and I watch him as he unbuttons that thing on his gun, and he's afraid to come all the way up. Comes up the pickup truck, you know, and I'm sitting here, and he's back this way, and he says, why are you driving that way? How much you had to drink? I said, a couple of beers. He said, well, what's that smell? Hell, it's his horse in the front seat. Highway patrolman, he finally comes around there and looks in there, you know, and what the hell is he going to do? If he takes us, drunker in hell, if he takes us to jail, he's going to have to put that horse in his car. He goes, where are you guys going? I'm going to Patterson Track. Well, don't go down Mooney Boulevard. Go out around the other way and get the hell out of here. I got a friend who is now, he was a highway patrolman for 20 years. I went to high school with him. And he is now in Alcoholics Anonymous, been sober, what, 2 or 3 years. And he was at the patrolman's, he was at the office when that highway patrolman come back. And they now have, a book of some of the stupid things we do when the highway patrol pick us up, and my name, and the horse in the front seat is in this book of a couple of the most stupid things that they've ever seen on the highway. But my friend that I graduated from high school, he was there when the highway patrolman stopped us, come in, tell him this, see? So it is documented. You guys happy now? Huh? Yeah. I'm going to wind this up pretty quick, you know, because I got some more good horse stories about taking one inside of a woman's house, but I know you don't want to hear them. I'll tell it anyway. I don't know about, if you know anything about horses, when you take them someplace warm, they got to go to the bathroom. And so this old horse been a trader, we've been to a roping, you know, and there's this Indian girl, I was really trying to impress her, and, you know, it's hard to impress somebody at 6 o'clock in the morning. And so I come by, you know, going to impress her, and she wouldn't get out of bed, and I went in there and tried to get her up, and she wouldn't get up, you know, and hell, that's it, what's the matter with her, you know, and so I'll show her, so I went out and got the horse. I got him out of the trailer, you know, and I started taking him in the front door. And as soon as I got him in the front door, I took him all the way back to the bedroom if he had to shit in the front room. Right in the living room of this house in the middle of Isaiah. But see, this old stupid roping horse will do anything, see? So he's standing there and he's got his tail up. The fireplace right there. kitchen, and the cat's right here, and I'm leading him, and I see it. So, you know, I'm still drunk from the night before, so me being real smart, I think, what am I going to do? So I run around behind him and catch part of it. You take your horse in the barn, he'll go to the bathroom every time. In 1989, I don't know about you, but I was sicker than hell, but it wasn't from drinking. I ended up with a real bad colon problem, and I was in the hospital wanting to die. I ended up in the hospital 3 or 4 times, and my sobriety's been great to me. I've had a beautiful life, you know, and I got so sick, I lost all the fluids, I couldn't make decisions, you know, and I started bleeding on the inside, and I had little ulcers on my colon, and I felt awful, man. I wanted to die, and I ended up back in the hospital, and I almost bled to death in my own house. I went to the hospital and they sent me home and I hemorrhaged, and my little girl come in the bathroom and there I laid, and there's blood coming out of my bottom, you know, just all over that bathroom, and it looked like a mess, and I was blacking in and out, and I live out in the country, and they couldn't, my little girl got on the phone, she's 10 years old, and the wife got on the phone, they called 911, they couldn't get out there, and I remember laying on that old cold floor, you know, and I remember looking through that hallway, looking at my little girl, and she was talking to that lady. And that lady on the phone on 911, she'd say, how's he doing? Is he breathing? Is he conscious? And my little girl would say, yeah, he's doing okay. Dad, are you all right? Dad, are you all right? And I'd look at her, and then, you know, because I thought I was going to die. And they couldn't find me. They couldn't find me. And pretty soon they showed up. And I thought I was in a movie. You know, because they rolled me in there, and here come about 4 or 5 different people with all these hats on, and it's kind of like a movie, you know, and I couldn't, nothing would register up here, and they put me on this gurney, and I remember the old medic saying, we can't find an IV, we can't get the IV in, we can't get no blood pressure, we can't get the IV in, we can't get a blood pressure, and they worked and worked, and they was throwing them band-aids, you know, and they was shooting, and I'm laying there, and my little girl, my neighbor come over, and he got my little girl and took her home. And they put some kind of damn squeeze on me, man. I'll never forget that thing, but it pushed all the blood to the top. And then they got me in the ambulance and got me straightened, you know, and talked to me, and I finally come back around. They finally found a place they could get the IV. And I went to the hospital, you know, and I was in that hospital, and the nurse come in, and she said, that close to dying. 1989. Now see, I sponsor a few guys, you know, and I was so sick, I was wanting to die. I had heart monitors all over me. Jimmy come in, see me. Guy I sponsor. Jimmy was having a lot of problems. He's telling me about the relationship with no job, you know, and his women, and all these problems, his thinking problem he's having, And I'm laying there wanting to die, you know, and he stayed about 20 minutes, and after he left, I was grateful. Come on back, Jimmy. The only way I survived, he'd come in and see me every day. Another funny little thing, and I'll shut this up, is I went to a... I was going to die is what was going to happen, but I got friends. I don't know about you in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I got friends, you know, and they come in there and looked at me and they made a decision. We got to get this guy out of here. So a friend of mine got a hold of an airplane at King Air, you know, and they made all the arrangements. My wife got busy, got all this stuff, and they put me in King Air and got me out of this Band-Aid hospital, and they flew me to a clinic one morning, got me straightened out. By 8 o'clock, I had left, I say, by 8:30, I was in Santa Barbara at a clinic. And I'm dying. I couldn't even get 1 foot up on the stand to get in the airplane. Jimmy brought my car down, and we come on the airplane, and Jimmy picked us up at the airport and got me over there. Well, while I'm going over there, they're all having a lot of fun. Whole car's full of alcoholics and my friends, you know, and they're laughing, having a big time, and I'm dying. I almost bled to death, you know, a few days before that in my house. So here we are with this entourage, you know, and we walk into the Santa Barbara Hospital, and I got one guy under this arm, one guy under this arm, and they bring me in, set me down, you know, and Jimmy goes over there. They all had cowboy hats on. So people in Santa Barbara start looking at us. Who's that guy? Who's that guy? So Jimmy, my friend, he goes over there and he tells the nurse, and, hell, that's Larry Sloan, country western singer. So the whole hospital, these nurses coming around staring at me, wondering what song he does sing. They're looking at me like, I don't ever remember seeing him on television. They was having fun. They got me inside there, you know, and this old doctor, this rear end doctor, he stuck that thing up my rear end, looking at it through that damn scope, and he looked over at me and he said, where in the hell is the band at now? I prayed to die in 1989. One of the country western singers put out a song and said, thank God for unanswered prayers. I didn't die. Here it is, 1993. I spent a nice day today. We got up early, loaded the old horse, my beautiful wife, beautiful 10-year-old girl. We all got in the motorhome. My best friend Jimmy come over. We talked. We shared. We went to the team roping. We talked about Billy. We talked about Bay. We talked about the 12 steps. We talked about being up here. We talked about Alcoholics Anonymous. Talked about what a privilege it is to be part of this fellowship. If you're new, I want you to keep coming back. See, when I do die, God don't have to send any angels down because I got two out there in the motorhome. He may send some tortillas. They're both Mexicans. I don't know what that means. One of them is, if you hear it here, you leave it here. One of them is a Mexican. The other's only half. I took her to downtown, you know, and I told her, I said, we went to the grocery store, and we live in a little hick town called Farmersville, and we went downtown, and I said, now, Heather, you're half Mexican, and you're half Okie. I'm going to take you down to Farmersville and show you what Okies look like. We went down there, and she looked around, she said, Dad, I'm going to stay all Mexican. Her name is Heather Leanne Sloan. After a trip to Farmersville and looking at real Okies, like her dad, she changed her name to Heather Leanne Negrete Sloan. Silly kid. I'm going to shut up because Alcoholics Anonymous has done me a favor. For me being here, you know, and it's always a reward. It's always my blessing. I got more out of this meeting than anybody else. You know, my little girl has a seizure disorder, and I have a tough time with that. Just an example, and this is for AA, is I'm a guy who don't have the ability to stick out, to cowboy up, you know. But the thing that I understand about Alcoholics Anonymous, my little girl started these seizures when she was about 6 months old. And it just breaks my heart because they can't get any control, you know. And if you've never seen anybody in a convulsion, especially a little kid, it's rough. You know, when the eyes start shaking and she starts slobbing at the mouth and she quits breathing, we've made several trips to the hospital and I just fall apart, you know. And Alcoholics Anonymous has given me the courage to keep going because without me, she wouldn't have nobody to take her there. And she keeps me inspired, my little girl. You know, and that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is all about. It gives me a family, it gives me people that, are blessings to me. You know, I don't have the words and I don't have the time to tell you how great Alcoholics Anonymous is and what it's done for me. I've learned that you seek AA first, and everything else will be given to you. You ask and you'll receive. You follow these directions in this big book and you won't believe the blessing is going to happen to you. God didn't just pick me out and say, hey, old cowboy, I'm going to do a lot for you. God picked us alcoholics out, just like you. He's going to do a lot for you. He blessed my life. He saved my life. He's made me into a person that I never thought I could be. And so when I die, he don't have to send any angels, because I got some. And that's great. Thank you.